So, Paul, yesterday, Friday, was Isaac's birthday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Isaac, if you're a listener of this show and you're like, who? He's our editor. You've never heard of him, but he's listened to every episode and, you know, since Paul and I began doing it. I don't know. He's been the editor for a couple of years. And he's my son. And on Friday, he turned 17. So everybody wish Isaac a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Isaac.
We had a bit of good fortune. One of the things he got for his birthday was a soldering kit. And he's kind of had a couple of small monitors for a while, but we had this big monitor that had stopped working, went dark years ago, and had just been sitting in the corner. But he tore it apart, found a bulging capacitor, figured out what stuff he needed to replace that, and used his soldering iron tonight and fixed it. And that's the first time he ever soldered.
Wow.
And he fixed the monitor, and it's sitting on his desk right now as his main monitor. So that's a pretty... So basically, for his birthday, he got a monitor. So that's pretty cool.
And the capacity to generate as many monitors as he needs.
Right. It breaks my heart because I've had a couple of monitors go dark over the years, and people always said, oh, you know, it's probably a blown capacitor. You just got to rip it open. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. And I know, you know, that's one of those things. Once you know how to do it, once you know how do I tear it open? How do I identify the blown capacitor? How do I know how to find the correct replacement part, orient it, put it in? I technically know how to solder because I did it last time I soldered, I was about Isaac's age. I was about 17, 18. So it's been 30 years. So once I remember how that works, and it's like, you know, that's a lot of fussing around. And it was just never, I mean, it was probably worth it, but you know, you don't want to embark on a 2-day project and then have it not work out. Especially when, you know, your main job is writing and not fixing monitors. But now I have a son who can do this sort of thing. It's a shame. It wasn't that long ago we threw away all the old broken monitors. We're like, why do we still have these? Just get rid of them. And then a few months later, he learns how to fix them. But in the future, we'll be able to rescue monitors with blown capacitors.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it's one of those weird things where it's like, I know that this is possible, but the hassle, not only the hassle of actually doing it, but the hassle of like setting aside some mental space to figure out how to do it is just way too costly.
Right. It's like, do we have a soldering iron? Do we have solder? Do we have a place to work? Do you have a place in your, you know, where you live right now to do it? Like, we kind of had to set that up. There wasn't anywhere around the place to do that. And it, you know, it takes a while. Once you've already got all your tools, you know where they are, you know how to use them, you know how to do everything, it's probably an hour of work. But if you don't know what you're doing, you can lose a lot of time trying to figure things out.
Like learning how to use Blender.
Not that much time. So, you mentioned before we started the show you had been poking around on Steam. Which is more than I did this week. I haven't looked at Steam in a while.
Yeah, I figured since we're doing the diecast tonight, I should at least look at some games. I haven't played games in weeks and weeks now. So I boot up Steam, and I was like, all right, what's up? And Steam's like, we need to install an upgrade. I was like, okay, fine, install the upgrade. So then, after the upgrade was installed...
Can I do an aside?
Absolutely. Can I do an aside? This is your show, man.
This is all the time. In fact, I had Steam update on me. I started up Steam for the first time, and I've been playing on my PlayStation this week, so I haven't started up Steam in a whole week. So naturally, Steam starts up and needs to update, because it's like every week. Steam is constantly updating, and yet nothing ever changes. It reminds me of iTunes back in the day, where it's just like every few days there's another mysterious update that it needs to apply, and you sit there, and it was worse in iTunes because you had to keep agreeing to it, and you know, the EULA and everything, because Apple loves their, do you agree to this? And, you know...
As if they cared.
As if they cared. But it was a little more hassle back in, if this isn't what iTunes is like now. For reference, I'm talking about like 10 years ago, which is the last thing I touched stupid iTunes. But, you know, just these constant updates that never do anything. And you're like, what? Why are you updating? Hey, why don't you bundle a bunch of these together and do this once every 5 months? Why do you do weekly placebo updates? What is the point of this?
Yeah. Oh, man. I guess it's good that Steam doesn't look different, because that's kind of the whole point, is that you know where to look for things and you know how to change stuff.
Right. Oh, yeah. I don't want a bunch of stuff to move around. That's for sure. But you expect when there's an update that something will change. I would still like a...
Pony Island update on Steam where it just like the user interface starts going crazy.
Actually, I would love for Steam, I would love a light interface. I don't like the dark interface. I would like a dark text on a light background interface.
I wonder if there's a way to invert your monitor colors.
That is a very Linux user approach. Oh, this program doesn't... I'll just invert everything. I'll just... I'll just multiply all brightness values by -1 in this region.
And you go to show pictures to your family and it's like, ah, demon pictures.
So what'd you find on Steam?
Oh, man. So there's a couple of games that popped out at me. And one of them was Card Life. It's basically, you remember Godus by the Molyneux game, I think?
Yeah. Peter Molyneux.
Yeah, where all the terrain is in strata instead of like voxels or whatever.
Yeah.
So Card Life is reminded me of that. That was the first thing that popped into my mind, because it's like a whole world, kind of like Minecraft. It's basically Minecraft, but it's all made of cardboard instead of cubes. So like the whole terrain is made of these sheets of cardboard all stacked up on top of each other.
Right, like if you cut out sheets of cardboard and stacked them up, that's what the world would look like.
Right, yeah. And then your character looks like that. You can cut out your own character. Like, you have to hit some key points, but, like, basically you can make your own face and your own arms and whatever, and cut them out of cardboard. And you can make all the props in the game, you cut them out yourself, and so they're all cut out of cardboard, basically. And so you can make your own pieces that do certain things, you know, beds and walls and windows and things.
So, I'm looking at the trailer now. I'll put it in the show notes. Card Life looks absolutely enchanting. What I'm going to guess is that it's terrible to play. This is the thing. Peter Molyneux is always able to come up with these
captivating
ideas.
It's not Molyneux game. I don't think it's a Molyneux game. I don't think it is. Okay. I didn't want to load down the game itself with that, what is it, cannonball, an anklet?
Anchor?
Whatever it is. A millstone around its neck, maybe?
Right. Okay, so
it just reminded me of the aesthetic. I don't think it's associated with Molyneux at all.
Oh, okay. Okay, we're safe then. Okay, then who knows how good it is? It does look fascinating. I've never seen a game look like this.
Yeah, isn't it neat? I like how they did the corrugations. I think it's just a texture. I don't think they're actually modeling anything on the inside. I think they're just like... have a repeating texture along all the edges that's like corrugations.
Oh, and even there's even a slight cardboard wave on top of the texture on the surface that you walk on that you get on cardboard when there's corrugation underneath it. That is just a fascinating attention to detail. The trees, you know, look like you cut out the silhouette of a tree and you took several of them and intersected them. So it's 3D, but it's 3D made of several intersecting 2D planes. That is just super interesting. This is going on my wish list right now during the show.
Well, there we go. Success number one. Oh, and the clouds. If you look at the clouds, they're made of sheets of cardboard, too. It's just like, oh, sweet.
Also, I have to... You know what? I need to backpedal on something I said. I've been saying for a while that, oh, there's never anything added new to Steam. There is something new to Steam. I'm not sure how I feel about it. And this is honestly a question I have for listeners. Now when I go to a Steam page, the very top is often somebody streaming the game. Like right at this moment on Saturday night, there's a woman streaming Card Life. And that's the top of the card. Now, and of course, I don't mind seeing that. That's interesting. Oh, here's somebody playing the game I'm looking at. Maybe I want to check it. Now I can see the game in motion. But having it above the game itself feels weird. Like it's more important to watch somebody else play it than to read about it or to watch the trailer. Like this, the user experience, this shared streaming experience supersedes the developer's own branding and trailers and marketing. I don't want to say I disagree with it. I'm curious what other people think of this.
I, for one, welcome our new streaming overlords.
I haven't done streaming in months and nobody's complained. So I think people like it when I stream, and there's always 50 or so people show up, which is apparently pretty good for somebody who barely streams, but it seems like it's a nice bonus thing that, you know, that's not like my primary content, and I don't think anybody misses it when I don't do it. Also, I don't want to stream now because, like I said, we're moving, so I've torn down all the stuff off my walls. So instead of the picture, all the cool art and stuff behind me, it's a bare wall, and it would be too depressing.
Aww.
Hope we move soon. So tell me what else, tell me more about Card Life or what else you found.
That was basically it. Just like, this looks neat, and I'd be interested in maybe playing it. I watched a little bit of the stream, and I was like, okay, Minecraft, but with a different aesthetic, and you can make your own things look kind of cool, and the trees don't take a billion years to chop down. That seems like good.
That's sold. The trees don't take you 5 minutes to chop down. That's an important feature that I'm not sure why that's been a problem for so long.
Yeah. So another thing I noticed on Steam was Flotilla 2 by Blendo Games. Blendo Games did, they do very choppy, not pixely, but like hand-drawn, blocky graphics kind of stuff.
Yeah, like what
Quadrilateral
if you took
Cowboy
the...
is the...
Yeah. Like, what if you took kind of like the default avatar of Minecraft, only instead of him being pixelated, his big square body looked like it had been drawn in crayon. Like, that's their aesthetic, is super low polygon and then kind of this hand-drawn texture aesthetic. Oh, their stuff is always really interesting. It's not a traditional game.
Stylized.
They mess around. Yeah, very stylized. Their gameplay is stylized too. They don't do like a linear narrative. They're always messing around with weird stuff. They're very experimental. Yeah.
So they made a game called Flotilla, and it's like a 3D tactical. It was like Homeworld kind of with the, you know, spaceships in space, and you can position them, and you can't control them really directly, but you can tell them what to do.
Right.
So they recently came out with Flotilla 2, and it's like, oh, that looks cool. Like, I'd like to play that, but it wasn't showing up in any of my lists. So I was like, oh, why not? And it's because it's VR only. So I can't buy it and play it. Like, it's not available, apparently.
Why make this? I mean, I can understand some games being, you know, necessitate VR.
Sure.
You know, the Saber game that everybody's going crazy over, where you bash stuff up with lightsabers, or the games where you like stand in the middle of the room and shoot stuff coming at you. I understand that. That really is an experience. But why is this RTS looking thing VR only? That's weird.
Yeah. The only thing I could think of was that maybe they got a bonus for making it a VR exclusive. Which, I mean, if they did, good for them, and fine, you know, that all makes sense. But it just seemed weird that it was like, there's no reason why this needs to be a VR game. It could be VR and for PC, right?
Sure.
So that was kind of disappointing. And then while I was looking around at spaceship games, I stumbled upon Nimbatus, which is RoboCraft or...
Well, I know exactly the game you're talking. Go ahead and describe it. This is what I got Isaac for his birthday.
Oh, fun! So there have been a few games like this where you build a vehicle and then you can pilot it around. Siege, what was that? Siegecraft or something, like the Siege Engine Simulator game.
Yeah.
RoboCraft, Star. There's like a kind of a, like a Minecraft Starship game where you could do this kind of thing. But all of those have been in 3D, and this is in 2D. And it reminds me of some of the old, like, Starship games, or kind of like Moonlander. It's basically like Moonlander, only instead of trying to take off, you're trying to, like, bore into the center of the planet, more or less.
And you've got to build the drone yourself, like, put thrusters on them, assign right. thrusters to various movement keys, decide where the lasers go, and stuff is trying to kill you sometimes.
And then all the components are controlled by keys. You can just bind it to whatever you want, and so you can have a really complicated interface, or you just have one button that like goes forward and shoots everything. And so it was like, wow, this looks like a really cool game. And but that's as far as I got, because I was like, all right, well, now it's time to go record the diecast, and I'm not gonna buy it right now. So
I was actually I got it for him with ulterior motives. He wanted it, so I got it for him. It was on his wish list. But I also wanted to hear what he thought of it and see him play it, because I was curious. Because I wanted to get it, and I wanted to know if it was worth my time. He played it for, I think, 3 or 4 hours today, so that's a good sign. I haven't talked to him about it yet. But I mean, we talked briefly, but I didn't, like, get his deep dive on it.
Can we have him just, like, put his deep dive in, like, insert it into the diecast?
I know he'd say no. I know okay. He would say no. He just doesn't want to talk. He's just too shy. He's more shy than I was at 17, and I was a shy guy.
Fair enough. All right, well, anyway, I'd love to hear anything you have to say about any reviews, because it looked really neat, and I was like, I'm really tempted to buy this, even though it's $20, right? It's early access.
Yeah.
$20 seemed a little steep, but...
Yeah, I thought so, too.
Yeah, I don't know, yeah.
For an unfinished 2D game, there's an interesting conversation to be had there about which do you do? Do you make the game expensive at first and then it gets cheaper at launch?
Yeah.
Or do you make it cheaper before launch and then have it go up to its regular price? Like Factorio, the price went up when they got to their final version. And right. other games, like it.
Minecraft did that off, too.
Yeah, you start off with the higher price and you make sure that the people who buy in are the ones really caring about the game and are really sure. engaged. They're your core audience. And then you don't want too much, like you don't want to sell too much, because I don't want 100,000 people submitting bug reports. I want 1,000 yeah. people, right?
Yeah.
Just for ease or of ideas
or on the forums or whatever. Yeah. You kind of want to restrict right, your right. community at the beginning, or you might want to.
Right, you might just want it to not get too big so that you don't spend too much of your time on community management. There's something to be said for having a tighter-knit community, and paradoxically, just charging more, less people will buy it, so you'll have a smaller group of people who will be a more hardcore audience.
Like, you could make it a really cheap version for early access where you just get the game, you get to play it, but no community, no feedback, and then you make a really expensive version early access where you get to be on the forums, you get to suggest ideas, and you get to provide feedback and yeah. stuff, and then as you progress through, it converges on the final price of, you know, whatever you're going to sell it at launch.
Well, the other danger of low price up front is some people will be like, oh, that's cheap, and they'll throw in their cart and they'll play it, and it's and then, you know, they're not connected with the devs.
Oh, sure.
And they're just, oh, it's a half finished game, and they'll just leave a bad review and wander off. And meanwhile, they might have fallen in love with the game if they had waited until release. So that's a
right,
reason maybe
true.
You want to start with a high price and lower it later.
All right, I'm convinced.
But that's a paradoxical thing. Like, the better it is, the cheaper it is. Like, that's a funny... either way you look at it, you can find situations where it's all, okay, so you want to charge more for the broken version and less for the great version.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just going to always charge $20 for it, and that's just the sale price.
That's true. It does seem a little high. Okay, on one hand, I like that games, that indie games have stopped fighting over the $2 and $3 price point. It just yeah. got crazy down there. And I think a lot of games were selling themselves short. And they've come up in price. On the other hand, a few of them do feel a little high to me. Like, I don't know that I can justify, you know, buying... an early access 2D side-scrolling game for $20. Yeah, that seems like a bit much. But, you know, it's a bunch of people. It's not like this is the wonderful thing when you have thousands of individual developers instead of one mega corporation making these games, is they're all just trying to find out what works.
Absolutely. Yeah, charge. I mean, they should charge whatever they feel is right. And sure. Like I said, I was interested, but I was like, if it's like $12, I'll totally buy it. If it's like 15, maybe, and it's 20, I was like, that's too high. But the other thing that jumped out at me on this, on Nimbatus, was I was looking through the screenshots, and there's this screenshot of their tech tree, and it's like actually a tree, and it's like fanning out in all directions, and I was just like, oh man, I gotta get this game at some point. That is too cool.
they know your weakness, Paul.
Yeah, that's right. Massive damage.
Psst, hey kid, you want some upgrade trees?
Oh no, I can't come back. That's the stuff that jumped out at me on Steam, just in like a 20-minute session of sitting down and browsing through stuff. I'm sure there's tons of good stuff out there. What do you think is cool on Steam? Leave a comment in the space below.
Actually, I know you said that in a sarcastic voice, but I would actually appreciate it if people did that. I'm just curious what people are doing these days, especially, I mean, you know, you don't need to tell me if you're like playing Red Dead. I mean, go ahead if you really want to. If you're playing Red Dead Redemption or Rise of the Tomb Raider or Spider-Man. But, like, sure, everybody's playing those games right now because they just came out and those are the AAA stuff. The stuff I'm really curious about is the fringe stuff that doesn't get headlines. And, you know, you'll discover, hey, here's a wonderful game that hasn't been discovered yet that's really good, or it's just really weird and, you know, it's worth talking about.
And if you do have a something to say about, like, Red Dead Redemption, for example, there is a thread on the forums called This Week I'm Playing, and it's got, like, 320 pages or something of comments. And people just post what they're playing this week and, like, what they think about it. So that would be a great place to go for that kind of thing.
Those are always, like, really good. And I'm always glad when I read them. But I never remember to go to the forums. Like, every time I go to the forums, I'm happy at what I see there. But I don't remember because the rest of the website keeps me busy. And it, like, doesn't funnel you there. But that's my design that does that. Is I don't want, like... masses going in. But the thing that, you know, it's designed for the more hardcore members of the audience.
Yeah, and
right?
The community is happy. Yeah, the community is happy that it's not overwhelmed by people all the time.
Right. We wouldn't want 10,000 people in there. It would just change the whole dynamic. So I like it. So by design, you know, the site doesn't send you there. But that means that I don't remember to go there unless I get some moderation notice. Yeah, I don't go there either. But when I do, I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a post from so-and-so. Oh, that's cool.
Reading stuff on the internet.
How does it work?
Well, that's what the comic book industry wants to know.
So, actually. So, this month, I've been writing Spider-Man. And there's a lot of, you know, just because it's a game made... Spider-Man, the newest game for the PlayStation 4, has a couple of comic book industry veterans on the writing staff. And you can really tell it's not structured like a movie. Like a typical, just if they went off on their own, a typical developer would try and take a movie plot and stretch it out over a video game length by inserting just endless side quests. And it would be all long and meandering. Grand Theft Auto 5 is the poster child for this, where it's like, there's no central threat, and there's no, like, big thing, and, like, what's driving this story? It's just all over the place, just because it's just a bunch of stuff to do. But the Spider-Man game is very much structured like a series of comic books. So it's not a three-act story with beginning, middle, end. It feels like you're reading a series of comic books that at any given moment, you've got a main threat, and there's a main story going on, and, you know, a main villain. But there isn't a single cohesive thing over the whole thing. It feels Well, there kind of is, but, you know, it feels like a series of comic books where sort of plot threads come and go. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. In a movie, the main arc that encompasses the entire work is the central focus. In a comic book, the sub-arcs are the central focus, and then there's a main arc, but it doesn't really jump out at you all the time.
That's a really good way of putting it, yeah. That's actually a really good way of putting it. And yeah, that's what this game feels like. It feels like a short run or a mini series of comic books. But while writing this series, I kind of felt like I needed to look up all these references. There are a lot of... I kind of got caught in a rabbit hole, right? Where it's like there's a moment where Spider-Man's lifting some rubble, right? And it's actually a visual callback to one of the most famous Spider-Man comics published way back in the 60s of him trapped underneath a bunch of rubble. No, it's... In the comic, this was like this defining moment of the character where he like had to dig deep to save himself. And in the comic, it's just sort of a wink. If you happen to be familiar with this particular image of Spider-Man, then when you see this QuickTime event, you'll go, oh, it's that thing.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. And there are a bunch of them in this game. And I've found several and I'm sure I'm missing more. But in doing this, in playing this game, I kind of had to like familiarize myself with what are comics doing these days? And so I've been like just reading endless Wikipedia articles about comics, and it started getting me thinking, you know, I should just read some current comics.
Yeah,
you know where this is going. This was a problem several years ago. I subscribed to Marvel Unlimited, I think it's called.
Yeah, I remember you talked about it with Mumbles, I think.
Yeah, and it was a really good value. Like, I forget, it was like $10 a month, and you could just read so many comics every month. And I thought it was an excellent value, but I quit the service because the interface was so horrible. It was like, if you searched for Spider... Like, if you use the search engine, I want to find a Spider-Man comic. All right, I'll just type Spider. Hit Enter. It would not find Spider-Man. That is how bad their search engine was. Their internal. It was so atrocious. Like, and when it did find something, okay, I'll type Spider-Man. It just returns them in random order. Like, there's no way to, like, present me the run of Amazing Spider-Man in chronological order that I can read through. I don't know what order they were in. Alphabetical. Like, it was so hard to just sit down and enjoy reading comics for a while that I eventually canceled my subscription. So I tried again, this time with Comixology. It's way better than Marvel was. It has a decent search engine. I will say that the prices, they do. Comixology does the trick where they'll have this, you know, super long series and you can read the, you know, maybe it's 10 issues long, right? And they'll have the first 8 as available. Like, you subscribe to their monthly service and you get all these comics free. And you get the first 8 for free, but then you have to buy the last 2 issues, like, individually. That's a little annoying, but I could deal with that. But my main gripe, and this goes to Marvel Digital Comics too, is digital comics are way, way too expensive. Like $20 for a, what do you call it? A large anthology.
Season?
I forget what you call it.
Oh, okay.
A graphic novel. Like $20. And it's like, okay, I know in the comic book store, this graphic novel is $20. But I'm buying a digital version. You didn't have to print it on paper. More importantly, I can't, like, put it in a plastic bag and sell it later. I can only read, it's only for me. It can't be resold. Trying to charge me $20 for it, I couldn't possibly consider paying $20 for that. It's outrageous. And it happens all the time. It's just, they just slap the same stupid price on digital goods as they do on physical goods. And it makes no sense because it's actually worth less since I can't resell it. You know, and if I didn't like this series, I'll turn it in and use that money to buy more comics. You can't do that. So it's actually worth less, and it cost them less to produce. And the other thing is, for years, I don't know if it's still a problem, but for decades, literally decades, the comic industry had this horrible distribution problem where there was basically only one company that would print your comic and take it to the point of sale, right? Like whatever bookstores or whatever. There was just one company for Marvel and DC. They had a complete chokehold. They would actually tell Marvel and DC, you know, we're only going to take, you know, I don't know, 500,000 Supermans this month. That's how much we think is going to sell. And that's all we're going to either print for you or deliver, however it worked. Like, wow. they were able to, because they were the only ones in the game. And I don't know if that's changed. I would hope that's changed. Last I heard about this was the 90s. So, I have not been paying attention to this super back end of the business. But the point being, digital is your salvation here. There's nobody between you and the end user. It's all gravy. You get to keep everything. Why would you make the price high? That's insane.
Unless that same company owns all the digital distribution rights too and is just racking up the prices so they can keep selling paper copies.
I don't know. It seems crazy. It's actually like, I was like, all right, I've got $20 here. I'm going to buy some comics with my $20, and I couldn't bring myself to, but you know, oh, that's, I'm not paying $4 for a comic, for a digital, like, I think, for one thing, I think comic books themselves are way too expensive. Like $3 and $4 for a comic book, you're done reading it in a couple of minutes. There's just no way it's worth it. No way. And then to import that same price point to the digital world seems insane.
Especially since you can go online and find webcomics completely for free, thousands and thousands of pages of them.
Right.
And they're really good these days. And it's like, you can't just decide that your product is worth more than these guys, and they're giving away for free.
If anything, the one that really perplexes me is Marvel. They've got Disney over them. They're not going to go broke. Disney could even just see the comic as part of the marketing for, not the movies, because they're different continuities, but bringing people in and getting them into these characters. You know, even if you sell the comics at cost and you just use it to float ideas and whatever ideas work with the audience, you put in the movies. I mean, that just seems like make it part of your marketing and your sort of test bed, it you know, so that when you make that $200 million blockbuster, you know you've got a story that works, that resonates with people, and you know you've got a bunch of people already interested in that material. It seems like a way to, even if it doesn't make money on its own, it can protect these gargantuan investments you're making on the movie side.
And it can serve as a testbed for all the visual stuff that you're throwing out there, like the scene from Spider-Man, where you've got this iconic scene and everyone loves it, and then you can throw it in the movie and just be like, and make a nod to your fans.
That's cool, too. Oh, they did. Oh, I forgot to mention this. The Spider-Man Homecoming also had the same, also referenced this same thing near the end of the movie when Spider-Man gets buried under a bunch of rubble and he has to, like, it's the moment where he starts, you can do it, Spider-Man, or whatever, talking to himself. Or you're Spider-Man, or I forget what he was saying, but he was pushing the rubble off of himself. And he was the same thing. The movie, the tone of the movie was much closer to the tone of the comic book. Both of them represented this moment where the character was pushed to the limit, and other people were counting on them, and they couldn't give up now. And in the video game, it was just like, hey, visual nod. But yeah. So yeah, that moment has been, but you're right. They can use it as a way of making people more interested in this content. it's not like the old days when comics just had to fight to survive and stay in, but they just had to make enough money to pay their artists and writers, and it was just tiny, tiny margins, and they were just fighting for every dollar, because the printer takes a cut, the distributor takes a cut, and then the point of retail sale takes a cut. And so how much, and any unsold issues, you eat the cost of all unsold comics. So right. It is just brutal. It just, printing comics in the old days, before they became, you know, this cultural centerpiece, was just such a hard fought business. And now they've got Disney money, and even if they can just barely break even, that's fine. It can just serve as sort of the marketing arm of the movies. I mean, you know, what they spend on marketing the movies, one of these movies, what they spend marketing one of the Marvel movies would probably keep the comics going for a couple of years. It's just not even a big deal. It's just such a trivial cost. It seems like it should be something Marvel shouldn't have to worry about anymore. If not, you could even probably make a business case for giving away all comic books, not charging, like, digitally. You know, just right. From now on, just anybody
free online.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah, free online digital comics, and just get people into them and see if that gets more people into the theaters or just keeps the hype going and just further buries their DC. Then again, does Marvel need to try that hard at this point? They are just winning by so long a margin.
Oh, man. But DC could do that. DC could give away all their digital comics. I mean,
right?
Like,
well, they don't.
That
have
would be a great plan.
Well, they've got Warner Brothers over them. They don't have the Disney Corporation and their endless vault of infinite cash. But yeah, I mean, they've got Warner Brothers money. It seems like that should work.
Webcomic guys are doing it anyway, so it's like,
right?
You know, it's possible. It's possible to do it. Make money selling merch.
What do you say we do a mailbag?
Yeah.
Dear Diecast, many game have included the island of Manhattan in New York as a game world due to it being iconic while at the same time easily isolated for a game world, yet at the same time a metropolitan area is developed for residents, not gameplay. I think that needed a little more punctuation, but we got through it. If you were to be doing an open world based on New York, how would you attempt to do it? Okay, first of all, let's just jump down here. Yours, JDMM. Thank you for your question. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Manhattan is like the perfect thing for if you need a city in your video game. Like Grand Theft Auto 5 has the problem where this game takes place in the state of San Andreas, which is roughly California, except it's surrounded by water. And I don't know how long it's been since you were in geography class, but that's not the case for California. It is not surrounded by water.
I noticed that too.
Right? But you have to, that's the problem. You have to wall in a game world, because if you don't, it's really annoying. You're just driving down the road and all of a sudden you're leaving the game space or you're leaving the game area and you're like, well, damn it. Well, then why is there a road here? But okay, well, how do we keep players in the playpen? Sheer cliffs are ugly and they block the horizon and, you know, they're not realistic. And so water is pretty much your go-to solution. But how many places are isolated by water?
Hawaii.
Yeah. Right. And you know, that's probably a big part of the reason that the Just Cause games take place on a chain of islands. Because you can just, there's your game world. These small islands that are very close together. And you don't have to ask, hey, if I have a plane, why can't I just leave and go to everywhere else in the world?
Right. It's an elegant solution.
Right, Manhattan is perfect. And the renditions of Manhattan that we've been getting over the years have been getting bigger and more sophisticated, which I think is interesting. Spider-Man is not quite as big as the real Manhattan, but it feels as big as the real thing. It's they're, you know, every graphics generation, these major, the man, whatever version of Manhattan we have gets a little bigger. And what the end of the question is, how would you attempt to do it? I have no idea. Using current technology, back in the day, it would definitely be trace a map, do some sort of proc gen on it. That's how I would handle it, like in the early 2000s. You know, trace a map and do some proc gen, and then hand make a couple of the iconic buildings. I have no idea. I think they just solved this with just sheer manpower.
So I think that the hint that they're offering us here is really interesting about the island of Manhattan being developed for the residents who live there. So like, if you live in Manhattan, it's like, oh, I can play this game where I live here, and then I can go and like blow up my actual apartment building or whatever.
Right.
And that's really fascinating, because it seems to indicate that there is a significant portion of their audience that actually lives in Manhattan.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of it that way, but I mean, I'll bet you New Yorkers do love to see the virtual versions of the virtual versions of their city.
So yeah, to me, building a virtual Manhattan is a non-starter. Like, why would you do that? Why would you burden yourself with being consistent with a real life location?
And they are pretty consistent, like, with the limited things. I mean, it's a simplified representation, but you can go and like, oh, here's Harlem, and it looks very different from the financial district, which looks very different from Central Park.
If I had to do New York, probably the first thing I would do would be to buy the geometry from Google.
Buy it. Yeah, I suppose.
Because they've got scanned, they got 3D like geometry for everything there.
Although it's not very HD. It's not in high enough definition that you could like play a video game on it.
Oh, right. But then, I mean, take that and then do some proc gen on it. Like you were saying, you know, slice it up into layers and put some interiors. I don't know what kind of game it is that this hypothetical game is, but if you have to go inside all the buildings, then probably I would just like generate interiors based on some sort of procedural thing and leave it at that.
The thing I find fascinating is, how do you get, like, okay, we have 50 people building this right now in our office. We've got 50 artists all, you know, placing, or maybe not 50, but we've got more than one. How are they all working on this virtual world at the same time? Like you'd have to make a tool that somehow has this online component where we can collaborate, where I can be working in Midtown plopping down buildings, and you can be working in the financial district plopping down buildings. I just can't imagine that one person
are ways to do that, because they do that in movies too, where they're working on multiple assets at the same time that all fit into one place. And I know a lot of it's done with linking, where they have their own models and then they're all linked into the master model, so everyone can view the master model without editing it, and then they can see how their stuff fits in together. And then every once in a while, someone will go in and rearrange elements to make them all fit better, something like that.
Yeah. I'm very curious, because it seems like this does not seem to be part of the game engines that you get. I've never read anything indicating that, say, the Unreal Engine has this type of collaborative tool. I mean, if you want to do something like that with one of these big engines, that's all on you to figure out. And so it seems like everybody that makes an open world has to figure this out, unless there's some middleware that I've never heard of. You know, you need it for the Mafia games, you need it for Spider-Man, you need it for Grand Theft Auto. None of those companies, you know, those are from all different companies, so they're not sharing technology. So what is this mystery tool? If anybody in the audience is a AAA developer on any of these open world, like, city games, I don't have a hard time picturing how it works with, like, wilderness games. But in a in a city game where you'll have a street that goes from one end of Manhattan to the other. Well, if I change one end of the street, that's going to mess up the work on the other side of the island. Like, how do you even begin? And, you know, there's a lot of fussy stuff you need to do in a city. Like, we need a tunnel here, and then we need things over the tunnel, and you need to be able to go through the tunnel. So we've got multiple layers of content, and traffic needs to flow through there. So you've got, like, one person in charge of the scripting, one person in charge of modeling, you know, somebody's in charge of either they design the buildings or they take buildings that others have designed and they put them where they belong. And, you know, where do the dumpsters go? Where do the signs go? Where do the trash cans go? Where are the newspaper stands? All those little filling in the world with clutter decisions. You know, placing all the stupid streetlights. Some of that might be proc gen. Some of that might be done by hand. But it has to be done by multiple people working in the same world. And at the same time, somebody needs to be setting up. How do these traffic light, what, you know, the lighting cycles, guiding the AI of all the vehicles. And there's just so much work to be done. How do people collaborate on that? I want to believe there's a tool that makes it easy. Because it already seems like so much work.
So your first thing in your attempt would be extremely intimidated by the problem.
Yeah, that's my first thing, is be intimidated and then just give the whole thing over to ProcGen, which obviously would not get the job done. Actually, you might be able to get, like, if you just filled it in with random buildings and then you could just go in and replace the... No, you need the buildings to be the right footprint. Dang it, this is hard. I don't know. I don't
even know
how I'd go.
Well, you could always regenerate by block, right? You could generate, you get the streets from Google, right? Because Google's got the streets, they know how to drive around there, so they know where the streets all are. Then you just do a proc gen on all the blocks. You just fill them in with placeholders, just cubes or whatever. Then you identify what buildings you really need. Iconic, you know, skyscrapers, whatever they are. Key points in your story, maybe, things like that.
Right. Oh, obviously we need to have, you know,
Chrysler Building, what's whatever.
Yeah. What is the most famous building in New York? The one with the pointy top. Why have I blanked out on...
Anyway, then you go in, you place those buildings, and then you regenerate the blocks that they're in so that, you know, the other buildings all match and they're not intersecting or whatever. And then you can just tweak stuff and you just regenerate the blocks. And once you've got all the buildings located, then you can go in and start populating building geometry and stuff like that.
Empire State Building, you giant idiot, Seamus. You forgot the name of the Empire State Building. What is wrong with you? I am sorry for interrupting, Paul, but
I forgot it too.
Empire State Building. My goodness. I'm sorry. Continue.
Well, that's basically what I would do. You get the locations and stuff, place your key buildings, and then probably there'd probably be like 5 or 6 different stylistic zones, like, because there's probably different architectural styles in different areas, and then just generate all the buildings in that area with that same style and tie them all together, and then you don't have to hassle with it.
Huh. Still, it's a lot of work.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Here's the strange thing. I hope they don't really change it that much. They should just make a sequel and just give us the same city, except take the buildings that are... There's several buildings that are under construction currently. Just take it and finish those buildings. Here, I've read this somewhere. I don't remember that. I'll never be able to find the source for this. But I read something last week that said the places that are under construction in the game were under construction when the game started development. That there was like an area of Manhattan that they were building a bunch of buildings for whatever reason. I don't know what, maybe some zoning changed and they were allowed to build taller or whatever. But in the time that it took them to develop the game, the real buildings finished already. So now there's really a building there where you've just got this construction site in the game. Like, go ahead and change those into real buildings so that we can see them finished now. But yeah, I would be totally happy. You don't need to go any bigger. You don't need to. I know it's not one-to-one Manhattan. That's fine. I don't want this world to get any bigger. I think it's just the right size. It might even be a little too much. Don't get caught up in bigger is always better.
Run a funding campaign for people who want their apartment building to be in the game. And then they can pay like $200 or whatever.
I have the same thing with Grand Theft Auto V. If they ever make a sequel to this, I don't want them to like build Miami in this level of detail. I would love actually if they just built a little bit, if they added on to the edges of the world that they've already constructed. Maybe put an alternate world Seattle or an alternate world Vegas. And yeah, that's all water right now. I'd be totally fine with them just poofing into existence more landmass with cities on it. That wouldn't bother me in the slightest. And I would just love that if Grand Theft Auto just instead of rebuilding a whole new city, just kept growing this sort of mass of base cities that they have to work with.
Okay, so I was rereading this question, and that's a really valid like approach to it. Just like get your game world in, and then just like grow on the edges of it, but don't try to redo it every time you release a game. But what if instead of like based on New York in the sense that it's a replica of New York, it's based on New York in the sense that it's like inspired by New York, and then you could have the game procedurally generate a new city every time you booted it up.
Yeah, I'd be down for that. If any AAA developers are doing that, just let me know. I'll send you my resume.
That'd be so cool.
Like, there isn't much that could get me to leave this job that I'm doing now, but that could actually, a project like that could tempt me away from this gig I'm working now. What I have is a really, really fun job, and there are very few things in the world that could lure me away, but that would be one of them.
Leave your comments if you're a AAA developer.
That is somehow going to procedurally generate. Like, there's not nearly enough proc gen on AAA. That's all indies doing proc gen. AAAs so often just want super curated control, because it's all about. We need to have a big marketing campaign. Marketing campaign needs trailer bait. And that means big action set pieces of highly choreographed, motion-capped stuff. And that means it has to come in a stock world. So, yeah, you get trapped by the needs of AAA. But if somebody wanted to make a proc gen city, man.
You could do proc gen based on the city that the person who you're targeting the ad to lives in, and then like generate a new advert campaign for each town or whatever.
It's true. That would be fascinating if you could just change the parameters to get. Do I want to play in the fake Chicago or the fake Manhattan or the fake San Francisco? That's an interesting thing to do. Yeah, that would be fun. They do have proc gen city generators out there, but none of them have, like, a game built on top of them. They're just, hey, build this map. And it's not as easy as some people think. Once you've got a city filled with buildings, you're barely halfway there. You know, there's a lot of scripting you need so that AI can get around and so the world can behave coherently and so that lights can come on in the buildings, so that it can be rendered. Oh my goodness, I forgot the biggest step is how the hell do we render this in real time? Just because you have 80 million polygons doesn't mean you have a way to like present them to the graphics hardware in a way that will get you somewhere, you know, near a playable frame rate. All that level of detail, that's where a lot of your work is going to be, is getting level of detail working. Oh, I proc-gened a building, but I need like several different versions of it for and there's multiple graphics settings, and it needs to generate different versions of all three of those different versions based on what your graphics settings are. Yeah,
but you could always bake it backward into the block, in the placeholder blocks, right? And then show just the placeholders at long distances with the rendered graphics rendered on the surface.
You know, that's where I left off when I was working on Pixel City 2 in Unity, is I would left off working on level of detail stuff. So I don't know if that would have worked out or not. I was in the middle of figuring out, how close does the fake building need to be to the real thing? Like, that's the question I was trying to answer. And then I was like, too busy, need to get writing. This is eating all my time, but not turning into content. And that is a dangerous place to be.
Hmm.
All right. Let's knock out this one last, mailbag question. Dear Diecast, the comments on why Minecraft doesn't need a version 2 made by Microsoft in this article, link, I'll have it in the show notes, seem to gel quite well with some of Seamus's comments on how games companies should manage their properties. How do we feel about Microsoft these days? Kind regards, Gordon. I don't know. I'm conflicted about Microsoft all the time because Microsoft is like a three-headed beast. They've got their operating system, which is every day more and more creepy and Orwellian. They've got their developer tools, which are always great, but sometimes a little annoying, for reasons beyond the tools. Like, you know, pestering, update your Microsoft account. Do you want to tie this account to this account? Do you want to subscribe to our newsletter? Like, they really want to, like, talk to developers a lot, and that's annoying. But I still love their tools. And then the third head is the games development division, which is obviously what's relevant to this question. And they're all over the place. And sometimes they're making great stuff, and sometimes they're doing atrocious stuff. So, like, they have something that they have one part of them that's always awful, one part of them that's always great, and one part that oscillates all over the place. So, I have no idea how I feel about Microsoft these days. Continuously ambivalent. When it comes to their gameplay, I'm surprised that they have not done a sequel to Minecraft. That seems like a no-brainer. I understand, like, their rationale in this article is, hey, we don't want to split the community. Now, that's a great reason to not do it, but that's normally not something Microsoft cares about.
Right.
Since when do you guys care about community? Like, I'm surprised that they didn't at least say, well, let's try and make a Minecraft 2 and see if we get, you know, millions in sales.
Like, I think that probably they're terrified that they're hanging over a pit of piranhas of all the people who are making Minecraft knockoffs these days, and that if they come out with a version 2 and everyone's like, oh, we can jump ship? Awesome. Look at all these options now.
Yeah, that's true. Although, I have yet to see a single Minecraft clone that was really good. Every Minecraft clone out there feels like it was nobody's, like, really done a good one. They're all cranking them out, you know?
Yeah. And they seem to, well, we talked about this before, but they seem to be copying a lot of the idiosyncratic things about Minecraft instead of the really core attraction of it.
Right. And the biggest mistake is, I think, all the ones that are focusing on fighting monsters. There's a lot of those on Steam. Just, hey, yeah, it's a voxel world, but just fight this endless army of zombies. And I'm like, wow, that is just like, what if we took Minecraft, okay, and we took the worst part of Minecraft and made that the whole game?
Yeah.
Like, that is just, what if we made Grand Theft Auto without the open world and we just kept the linear missions? It's just like, wow, that is a bad idea.
And the nonsense storylines.
Right, right. But we got rid of the open world. Like, that's the only reason people are here.
Okay, I would love if someone would make a really clean, solid version of Minecraft that wasn't infinite, that was just like pocket worlds. Because that was one of the things I really loved about Minecraft in the early days, was that it was these little tiny worlds that you could really completely, it was like a terrarium where you could really manage the whole thing at once and kind of fit it all in your head.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Yeah. I do have the thing, once my bases get so big, and it's just like, but I want to tame the whole world, but you can't. I just want to put lights everywhere so that there's nowhere for monsters to spawn. And I've conquered this world, and it is sufficiently tamed. And you can't do that because there's just, it goes on forever. In practical terms. Huh. Yeah. See that? There's probably a mod for that. I know there's a mod for...
Oh, yeah, there are mods for stuff.
Yeah, but I know there's mods for ones where you just start standing on one block in space, and you just you just have to do stuff to like earn more game space to work with.
You we plant a tree, and then you chop down the tree and make stuff with the wood, and you get a seed, and you plant another tree, and then you work your way over to somewhere. Yeah, that seems like more grind than. Again, it's like, okay, the grind is not the part of Minecraft that I'm interested in.
Right.
But the latest update of Minecraft is really cool. All the ocean stuff. I remember way back in before the world, was it right after? Right around the time when the world went infinite, Notch went on a vacation to Hawaii and he talked about putting fish and kelp and stuff and coral and things underwater. And I was like, oh, cool, cool. And then, you know, 6 years later or something like that, it finally goes in, and it is cool. It's like, oh, great, all this underwater stuff is in, finally.
Oh, man, that might get me to play vanilla Minecraft again. Yeah, Minecraft under the ocean has always been super boring looking.
Yeah, it's neat now. Check it out. In between all the other stuff you're doing. Okay, before we sign off, I want to get, like, a real quick update of, like, Seamus's crazy life version current right now.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Book.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's 1/5 edited. Like, okay, we do a couple of editing passes. I made my main editor and she's looked through it. Okay, she's given me all her notes. And now I've gone 1/5 of the way of the game through the story, making fixes and adjustments. When that process is done, we launch the book. Oh, no, wait, then we have to have Heather format it for the book, and then it launches. Oh, it never ends. So, yeah, that's where the book is.
Okay, video game.
Video game comes after the book. So video game has not progressed in the last month.
Okay, and then move.
Move just got more complicated because, of course, that's we need. We started thinking about, you know, my parents kind of need help. They're living someplace that doesn't fit them really well. And we're living someplace that's too much for us. And, you know, Heather has one of her main jobs is taking care of old people. And my mom, especially my stepdad, Dave, has very late stage emphysema and could use a lot of help. I mean, is late stage emphysema. And he could use a lot of help, and just we want to make him as comfortable as possible for whatever time he's got left. And he's a bit of a handful for my mom. So wait, if we all live together, we could just buy a house together. And, you know, if it had some, you know, if it was easy for him to get. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of qualifications to that. So
right,
on top
right.
of
more
all
variables
these
to add.
Exactly. So now there's all these variables, like, can we even do this? Is a bank going to want to give a mortgage to this weird hybrid family? I have no idea. I have no idea if it's possible. It makes a lot of financial sense if we could make it work. But so that kind of reset our search. We've got all these places
right.
we're looking at.
Yeah.
Now we're like, well, maybe we should be looking for a place where we can include mom and Dave. We found the most perfect apartment last week, and we went there, and it was wonderful. The owner loved us. She was just the sweetest old lady, and she found out I was a writer and just was fascinated with all the stuff Heather did. And you could tell this is somebody who wants to lend to people they like, or to rent to people they like, right? That's the most important to them. And she just wanted us to have this place, and it was no pets. And I was like, great. And then I said, so just making sure there haven't been any pets in here. Oh, well, we're not letting any pets from now on. But of course, the previous owner had pets. And I hadn't gotten sick yet, but the doors were all open and air was flowing through. So I asked her to turn on the furnace, and she did. And I just stood over the register, and it was about 1 minute. Between that and the onset of the asthma attack, it was that bad. It would have been perfect. It was so. It was actually too cheap. They were actually not asking enough for the place. Oh, no. Like, I would have felt guilty taking it. This sweet old lady who probably could have been charging $200 more dollars every month for this place and easily have found a renter, but had it super cheap. It would have been so perfect for us, but the previous owner had a dog. So that's where our adventures are.
All right. Cool. That's perfect. Thank you.
All right. Everybody, thanks for listening. Paul, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show again.
See ya.